Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review. As today, we talk about the management of breast cancer and key papers and presentations from the past year. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Rebecca Dent from the National Cancer Center in Singapore, and Dr. Nancy Lin from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. Today, we're here to talk about breast cancer. And as in all of our programs, we will be talking about the use of non-FDA-approved agents and regimens. So check out the package inserts for specific products and approved indications. So as we do in all of our year in review programs, I've met with both of our faculty individually in the last couple of weeks to record pretty extensive presentations, reviewing in detail a lot of the great papers from the past year. Really encourage you to check out these presentations. They go through in detail. What we do today and what we do in all these webinars, we pick out some, not all, but some of the papers that were discussed and sort of try to take it to the next level, get input from the other faculty member, talk about clinical implications as well as research implications. Here are a list of the papers that our two faculty discussed. As you can see, there's a lot of great content in there. Again, I highly recommend that you check it out. Here's where we're heading. We're going to go through a bunch of different strategies and updates. But before we do, I just want to lead into the introduction by telling you a little bit about what our December as a CME group looks like every year. I know your December is always oriented around the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. But for us, as well as all general oncologists, we also have the ASH meeting. Usually one week afterwards is the San Antonio, although one year they were in the same week, and we went from San Antonio to ASH in New Orleans and arrived 1 a.m. and started the next day. We do all the programs on one day at ASH, so it's usually a crazy time for us. But I'm bringing this up because I'm kind of leading into the first paper I want to talk about in breast cancer. And I was just reflecting back on last night, we actually did a program. Nancy, we had your colleague from Dana-Farber, head of the CLL program, Jennifer Brown, on last night. And she, one of the main things we talked about was a study that she just presented at the ASH meeting the week before San Antonio this year, thankfully, on the AMPLIFY study, which is a new approach to first-line therapy, maybe is going to be practice-changing. A lot of people are going to get this as a time-limited treatment with BTK inhibition, acalabrutinib. It used to be indefinite. Now it's going to be for a little more than a year with venetoclax, all oral regimen. And for the first time, patients are going to have the option of this kind of combination. A lot of people are going to get treated. I bring that up because the paper I wanted to present, put out in front of you is something that actually, although it only affects maybe 10% of breast cancer, is actually almost the same number of patients that get CLL. And from my point of view, the PATINA study, which looked at triple positive breast cancer, so ER positive as well as, or PR positive as well as HER2 positive, we'll talk about that in a second. But Nancy, just looking about it, my own personal history of some of our highlights, at least from our CME perspective, of HER2 positive breast cancer. Last night we were talking about CLL and how the AMPLIFY data, in terms of the history, we just had BTK approved for the first time 2013. So the whole paradigm shift there. And I think in terms of triple positive breast cancer, maybe we're looking at the same thing. I reflected back on 2005, when the adjuvant trastuzumab data came out, Cleopatra 2011, Catherine data, which was recently updated, 2018, TDXD getting approved, that was 2019, it's now been 6 years, so we've had a TDXD, HER-CLIMB the next year, and then the HER2-LOW paper, DESTINY-Breast04. And now, from my point of view, one of the most interesting papers of the year, and in a long time that I've seen in HER2-positive disease was this PATINA trial. So Nancy, can you comment a little bit on what the PATINA trial looked at, what they found, and in particular, what I'm really curious about is both of your opinions about, is this practice changing? And what is it, and also biologically, what does this mean? So Nancy, any thoughts?
Yeah, historically, we've used CDK4/6 inhibitors in patients with ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer, but actually the preclinical data is very strong in the HER2-positive breast cancer, triple-positive state as well. And work from Shom Goel and Jean Zhao at Dana-Farber really showed that the CDK4 inhibitors can actually overcome HER2 resistance. So this was tested in the BATINA trial. So patients got induction, chemotherapy, trastuzumab, with or without pertuzumab, and then they went on in the setting of stable disease when you would normally be giving them maintenance therapy with HER2-directed therapy. They got HER2-directed therapy plus endocrine therapy with or without a CDK4 inhibitor, in this case, palbociclib. And the results were really astounding. The PFS delta was 29 months in the control arm to 44 months in the experimental arm. So this is like a very dramatic absolute gain in progression-free survival. And this is chemotherapy-free time for patients.
So before I get to Rebecca, Nancy, what does this mean in terms of first-line therapy of metastatic HER2-positive disease? Have you since San Antonio, I don't even know whether you can access Palbo, but have you been utilizing it?
We actually have been utilizing it. We've been offering it to patients. In patients who are coming right into that sort of maintenance phase, we're offering it. And then also for patients who are, and this is arbitrary, but for us, we've kind of said, you know, within a year, 6 months to a year of that maintenance period, we are actually telling people about the results of the study and offering it as an add-on. You know, the patient's already been 5 years on trastuzumab or HP maintenance. We're not really recommending it. But for people who are earlier on, we are, because I think this is such a dramatic result and the toxicity profile is very, very manageable.
So, Rebecca, I'm also interested in how you view this in terms of current patient care, but also the biology of what's going on here. You know, one of the things that always fascinated me was why post-adjuvant neratinib worked better in ER-positive than ER-negative HER2-positive disease. And all I heard was like something about, I've been hearing stuff about, you know, crosstalk is about as far as I've gotten on that. But any granularity about what's really going on here, Rebecca, biologically, and again, clinically, is this something that you think is going to become a standard quickly?
No, I appreciate your candidness because I think for the longest time, I've sort of thought about HER2-positive breast cancer, and I think we've really gotten excited. We have such important developments in targeting HER2 and what's driving these cancers. But ironically, this is such a heterogeneous group of patients. Like if you look at some of the neoadjuvant data, specifically Neosphere, let's say, where you're giving HER2-targeted therapy in the ER-negative versus the ER-positive, you know, the PCR rates with just two antibodies alone, you know, was nearing 40% without even chemotherapy. And so I think it's really important to recognize that biologically, these are very different. And so I thought this was such a great study. And I think building on preclinical data, understanding that it could overcome resistance in this context, you know, I don't know about you, Nancy, but for the longest time, you know, there wasn't even data about to put people back on endocrine therapy after they were on maintenance. And then finally, I think some of us were like, wait, why wouldn't we do that, right? You know, and I think, so we started doing that. And I think then, you know, this study emerged and I think people were like, we've really forgotten this group of patients. And what I see in my own clinical practice is that these really long-term responders where you're seeing, you know, HP for, you know, years and years tends to be more of this sort of HER2 enriched, you know, and so those are the patients that I think continue on HP alone. But the ER positive, HER2 positive, they are different biologically. And so I think this, again, this is looking at your clinical practice, looking at a clinical question matched with the preclinical important data. And then you see results, you see something that's clinically meaningful. So I think the big thing is that, you know, it is, if you're able to give the sub-Q HP and you're giving oral palbo and you're giving an oral agent, it still allows people to continue on a chemo-free regimen. One thing I have thought about though is, you know, in trying to think through, and I love Nancy's comment, okay, so what are we going to do with people that are, you know, many years out? No, we're not going to start giving them palbo if they're 4 years out. But my only sort of thing is like, who are those patients that can continue HP without adding therapies, especially if you're trying to sort of, you know, address costs? And I think the question is, could you sort of assess those patients and then on progression, could you give it? Or have things biologically changed by that time under the selective pressure of different treatments? You know, after so many years on endocrine and HER2, will you be able to rescue those patients? And I'm not sure that that question will ever be answered. So I would tend to agree with Nancy for the, I think, higher risk initially patients who you feel you want to give something, this is a really nice addition. It gives you a lot of comfort.
So we could keep going for a long time, but this is just like a tasting menu. You know, I love tasting menus, and we're just going to take a little bit. You notice here that even the response rate and clinical benefit rate is somewhat increased, although right now we don't have a survival benefit. All right, well, let's start again. We're not going to really focus on all the details of these trials. What I really want to focus on are clinical implication. And Rebecca, one of the things that you go through is the updates on the MONARCH E study of adjuvant abemaciclib, as well as update, you see data on age, et cetera. She goes through all that, as well as the update on the NATALEE trial. But I want to just use these new papers and more updated data, even presented at the St. Galen meeting. Here's kind of a, as always in oncology, our indirect comparisons. So let's just talk about it clinically. In patients, Rebecca, who are eligible for both of these CDK inhibitors, how do you think it through? How does it vary based on comorbidity, if they have GI problems, et cetera, et cetera? Right now, can you just paint a little bit of a picture about how you think through adjuvant CDK? Which one, which patients? Do you stick with the approvals or the trial bar, or do you go under that?
So great question. So yeah, so this is Angela DeMichel, and I thought she put nicely in a table to sort of give us a sense. And I think, to be honest, the data are remarkably similar. They're just looking at different follow-ups, right? So we know with ER-positive breast cancer, you know, these curves will continue to separate. I'll be honest, I was a bit of a naysayer. So I was, it's when it sort of reached the 5% mark where we all sort of feel compelled we have to start talking to patients about it. So the MONARCH E, you know, I think we're creatures of habit. So, you know, I've gotten quite comfortable at giving Abema in the adjuvant context. I know how to dose adjust, dose escalate, dose de-escalate, managing, you know, the sort of side effects, which for me is fatigue and diarrhea. I can manage the counts. I can manage everything else. So I really follow the MONARCH E for the majority of my patients. Also in Singapore, MONARCH E has been approved for some time, whereas NATALEE is just sort of emerging. I think where NATALEE comes in is it gives us more choices, right? Lower risk patients. We know that surgeons are de-escalating their surgery a lot, so they don't have to do surgery just to make the patient eligible for, you know, an adjuvant CDK. So I think that really opens up the opportunity for patients that are keen to go on CDK inhibitors. I think for us, those in clinical practice, what's hard is we're so used to our algorithm. And so now, once again, we have to adjust it. And it's almost like you have to screen your patients in clinic and sort of say, okay, what's the other thing I have to think about for these patients? And that's the challenge. And I think the other challenge for me is you're combining it with hormonal therapy, right? And so we tend to shy away, especially with Abema, from giving tamoxifen because of the risk of blood clots. And so, you know, you really have to be committed to doing the AI over ovarian suppression and CDK in sort of that higher risk group. So there's a lot to think about. And I guess the other thing when you're sitting down talking to patients, you know, scheduling is really important. So I'll be honest, in the adjuvant setting, I have to say I've gotten comfortable with Abema because I don't have to bring them classically, you know, 3 weeks on, 1 week off. I can kind of stretch it here and there once I've gotten comfortable with their schedule. But we have to remember there is no overall survival benefit when we're talking to patients. And I don't think we'll ever see that survival advantage because there's such heterogeneity in adjuvant ER-positive breast cancer in terms of just biology. The second thing is, you know, if patients relapse, there's such heterogeneity in how we treat these patients, and the biology is also heterogeneous. So it's going to be hard to navigate for us.
So Nancy, curious about your thoughts also about dosing. You know, in the NATALEE trial, they used 400, a lower dose. And then when Rebecca was recording her presentation, she brought up the issue. She usually starts Abema, I hope I'm quoting you correctly, at 100. I'm curious whether you do that. Also, we have a research to practice pool every webinar on how long it's going to take somebody in the chat room to bring up cell-free DNA. In this case, it's 13 minutes. So Hassan wants to know about cell-free DNA before starting PALBO, and whether you would look at that. But again, getting back to dosing, also the issue of 2 versus 3 years and how that factors your thinking.
Yeah, so I think, you know, because it's apples to oranges comparisons, it really is a discussion with a patient for the patients who are so-called dual eligible. For the low-risk patients, I offer ribociclib because that's really the population that was included in NATALEE and not in MONARCH E, but there's a large group of patients who would have been eligible for both. MONARCH, you know, abemaciclib is 2 years, but there's a GI side effects. with ribociclib, it's 3 years and more LFT issues, but less of the GI issues. And I think that to some extent, patients help us sort this out by telling us, and also somebody who has baseline mild elevation of LFTs, I'm going to shy away from the ribociclib. Somebody who has baseline irritable bowel syndrome, I'm going to shy away from the abemaciclib. So I think that from a practical standpoint, that's kind of how I've sorted out patients. Watch out for ASCO, because Erica Mayer will be presenting results of the TRADE trial, which is actually a dose escalation of abemaciclib in the adjuvant setting. So starting low and having a ramp up to try to mitigate the GI side effects. So we'll see what the data look like with that strategy. In practice, I'll admit I've done a poor man's ramp-up strategy because in the U.S. you have to get every dose approved, right? So I put people on 150, which is the usual starting dose, but I have them start it once a day, and then I have them go up to twice a day. There's no evidence for this, but this is what I do. I just find it's more tolerable than starting with a 150 BID. But I think we'll see what the TRADE study looks like, because I think if it looks interesting and promising, that that may sort of give us more evidence-based way to escalate the dose and improve tolerability.
That's interesting. It reminds me of the trial looking at dose escalation in ratinib and how successful that was.
Exactly. Right. Oh, I didn't get the CFDNA. Rebecca,
oh, yeah, ctDNA before Rebecca comments. Yeah, okay. ctDNA.
I mean, I personally would not check it. I think we don't know what to do with the results. If it clears, I don't know if we know what that means. If it doesn't clear, it probably means something bad, but I don't know that we would know what to do in terms of changing our therapy based on it. We don't have any idea what the clearance dynamics are in the adjuvant setting, so I would personally not advocate checking outside of a trial. So, I mean, there are trials to do this.
So a couple more papers I wanted to just bring up, particularly because when we were chatting before we got started, I was asking the faculty, they see a lot of people in second opinions. Are there things that people do that maybe you wouldn't do? And I was very surprised that Nancy brought up the issue of first-line therapy of ER-positive metastatic disease, that she sometimes see patients who get chemo. I mean, I'm not talking about chemo followed by endocrine maintenance. I mean, that's something else, but just chemotherapy. And Rebecca, you commented first on the Right Choice trial looking at ribo versus chemo, and then the PADMA trial, just from San Antonio, looking at palbo. Any broad general clinical comments, Rebecca? When you think about visceral crisis and a patient who needs to see treatment right away, are you comfortable using endocrine therapy in that situation? Do you try to give a little chemo first? Any comments?
Yeah, so as we were discussing, I think both of these trials, I think, give us a lot of confidence that it's very reasonable to give an endocrine and CDK inhibitor first line, and that these patients actually respond quickly, because that's, I think, that's the big thing people are uncomfortable with. Are they going to respond quick enough? Are we going to miss that window? And so both these studies, I think, give us a lot of comfort that even in the Right Choice, where they were compared it to a doublet chemo, which we don't use as much anymore, we're getting those responses. Again, I think back to Nancy's point of individualizing therapy. So I always say, if a patient gets admitted and gets diagnosed in hospital and has very bad disease, those are the patients I want to give chemo, because I need responses within days. If you can wait a week or so, that's where CDK and endocrine are helpful. Now, my patients have made me braver than I am brave, meaning they often say to me, I don't want chemo, I want endocrine and CDK. I've had patients with huge pleural effusions, symptomatic, and they've responded after like a week or two. So I'm more inclined to do this approach with visceral in terms of lung disease. I'm a little bit shyer in terms of, if someone has quite a significant elevated liver functions, even though on the Right Choice that was allowed, there weren't that many patients, I would say, who were, quote, true visceral crisis. And those patients, I'm more inclined to use palbo or to give abema, where, because we've had a few patients with ribo who had that increase in LFTs right away. So I think this is very reassuring for patients.
So serving in our tasting menu is the post-monarch study, the use of AI versus AI. Nancy, kind of, to me, a little bit counterintuitive of why this turned out to be positive, but it certainly does look like it's positive, and in a way kind of also leads into the EMBER-3 study that we're going to talk about in a couple of minutes. But can you just summarize what was seen there? These are, I guess, mainly people who got either palbo or ribo previously, who now are being, Bembo is compared to placebo. We saw more follow-up What's the bottom line in terms of the quality of benefit that you see there, Nancy? And is this a strategy that you use?
Yeah, so this study was looking at patients who had already been treated with an AI plus a CDK4/6 inhibitor in the metastatic setting. And the question is there value in continuing or actually switching to an alternative CDK4/6 inhibitor, in this case, abemaciclib, and then all patients receive fulvestrant, so they switch the endocrine partner. And I think that, you know, when we think about, well, how do people develop resistance to endocrine therapy, they could develop resistance to the endocrine component, right? They could develop ESR1 mutations, or they could develop resistance to the CDK4/6 inhibitor. But all the CDK4/6 inhibitors are also not identical. And Renath Jesselson in our group has done some very elegant work to show that even that the proteomics and the sort of genomics that happen in sort of dynamic range after ribo versus palbo versus abema are actually not identical. So they're not totally identical drugs. And what we're seeing is that we do see a PFS advantage with the continuation of CDK4/6 inhibitor, but specifically with abemaciclib. And remember, there was a very, very similar trial that looked at essentially palbo after palbo with a very similar design, AI palbo followed by fulvestrant palbo or not, and that did not show a benefit. So there is something to say about the switching here, I think, from one CDK4/6 to another. And again, all patients had switched the endocrine backbone.
So moving on to oral selective estrogen receptor degraders. Last night, believe it or not, we were talking about Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor degraders. There's androgen receptor degraders being looked at in prostate cancer. But of course, leading the group here is breast cancer. And first, SERENA-2, another oral SERD camizestrin. And we can talk about the difference. It doesn't seem to be huge between elacestrin, camizestrin, imlunestrin that we're talking about. But there's, you know, it's very similar data that's been presented for camizestrin as monotherapy. But Rebecca, the thing that really got everybody's attention, this is often the case in oncology, is a press release on this trial, which everybody's been really looking forward to, the SERENA-6 study. We haven't seen the data, but there's a press release out there, as is often the case, this came out last month, saying that this strategy, which is pretty unique in breast cancer research, at least it's been reported up to now, has a positive result. We're going to have to see with the details and whether it's positive enough to want to do this. But can you talk basically about what they did here, Rebecca?
So in my talk, I sort of lead in with the chemizestrin, you know, the earlier data, which look like chemizestrin seem to be particularly active in those patients that harbored an ESR1 mutation. And very often this is detected, as we know, under the selective pressure of treatment, specifically aromatase inhibitors. And so the idea was, and we've seen this from other sort of hints of this from other studies, that when these ESR1 mutations emerge, that a shift to an oral SERD such as chemizestrin might prolong or extend the amount of time people spend on this first-line endocrine plus CDK inhibitor approach. Because this is, you know, in our patients, you know, this is the most important, preserving that sort of first-line therapy and when to switch. And usually we do it on radiological progression. But the idea here is in SERENA-6, they're looking serially every 2 to 3 cycles and looking at tumor imaging as per standard of care. And if within that time they have ctDNA that's positive for an ESR1 mutation, then the patients are randomized to either switch to camizestrin plus the same CDK plus endocrine therapy, or discontinue the same treatment. So it's this earlier switch before radiological progression when you just see this emergence. Now, I think the key thing, and the primary endpoint was PFS, the key thing for clinical practice is that PFS is going to have to be quite impressive for us to, you know, change clinical practice. I think the second thing is, you know, how many patients do they have to screen to get to that randomization, right? Because this could be thousands of patients, and how often in clinical practice are we going to have to go looking for these ESR1 mutations, because we have patients on, you know, this combination for 3 years. We're not going to be testing every 3 months. It's certainly not cost effective. So I think we're going to see a lot of studies emerge trying to look at the longitudinal course of these ESR1 mutations, looking at detecting them, but also comparing the technologies. They're not all the same. This is using a garden assay, and, you know, does this apply to all assays? So I think it's very exciting. It could provide this paradigm shift. I think the hope is in the future we won't even have to do scans, but we are far, far from that. And I think that's really important for those people that are out in clinical practice. And so we'll have to await the actual results.
Nancy, any thoughts? I can imagine a lot of patients hearing about that and bringing it up to their physicians. And, you know, I would imagine a lot of them would be tempted to at least look for ESR1. Who knows what to do? I guess we'll have to see the data. It's often the case. A lot of the endocrine trials that have come out in the last few years have pretty good hazard rates, too. So, because it wouldn't be totally shocking if it was a really strong hazard. The AKT trials have pretty good hazard rates. Anything you want to add to Rebecca's comments, Nancy?
Yeah, I agree with Rebecca that, you know, a two-month delta in PFS is not going to change practice. But I think a more dramatic delta in PFS could change practice because it allows people to be on endocrine therapy for longer, and it's a reasonably well-tolerated drug. I think one of the practical questions that will come up is how are we going to test for ESR1 mutations? Like, do we really need to send a full NGS panel every time? Can we just develop ESR1? Like, they literally just detect ESR1 and they're cheap tests and you can repeat them on a regular basis. I think that will make it much more practical, but it remains to be seen how it ultimately ends up being implemented.
So we were talking about our experience going to San Antonio and ASH, you know, like in the same week. And, of course, ASH, you know, we do everything in one day, so it's kind of hard. It's just before the meeting even starts. But San Antonio, we usually do three meetings. And as we're presenting, stuff's being presented, and I get to run it by the faculty. And this year, I had Kamal Javari, as usual, in one of our programs, and we were doing three programs. I was asking everybody, because it had already been presented, what the heck does this EMBER-3 trial mean in terms of clinical practice? What an amazing study. But, Rebecca, a little challenging, at least for me, to figure out exactly how it's going to be applied. Can you kind of give us, a, I guess, 35,000-foot view of the study and then where you see the implications heading?
I think this is... all these studies are emerging at a time when, you know, the whole landscape is changing, right? So, you know, when someone is on an adjuvant CDK inhibitor and then they relapse, or they're on a first-line therapy of endocrine and CDK, then what do they do when they progress? And this is what a lot of the trials are looking at. So this EMBER-3 is looking at imlunestrant, so which is the Lilly compound, which is another oral SERD. And here it's, again, looking for those patients that are recurring in the adjuvant or recurring in the sort of first-line setting, and then looking at giving a single oral SERD, single-agent endocrine therapy, or the combo, which was added later as, you know, this field is so dynamic, that third arm of imlunestrant plus abema. And so, you know, not surprisingly, this abema combination with oral SERD clearly seemed to be better. And I think the thing that really stood out for me was that the benefits were quite dramatic among those patients who have an ESR1 mutation, but it seemed to actually be beneficial in those even without an ESR1 mutation, even though the benefits were modest, which is a bit different than we were seeing with the other compounds. And then I guess the other two things are even in patients who had CDK inhibitors, and then even in patients who harbored a PIK3CA mutation, because as we're going to see with the iNova data, we are going to have some options. But what this showed is that with that combination, we did see improvements in terms of efficacy. And then, of course, everybody would have liked to have seen a third arm of fulvestrant plus abema, because I don't think single-agent endocrine therapy is my bias. After progression on a CDK, I really don't think single-agent endocrine therapy is that active, quite honestly, unless, you know, you've been on your endocrine therapy for in the adjuvant setting for more than 10 years or first line for years and years. I think the majority of patients can't get single-agent endocrine therapy.
So, Nancy, actually, another one of your colleagues, Hal Burstein, did the discussion of EMBER-3. And, you know, for years he would present trials comparing, looking at CDK inhibitor and say, I know I'm not supposed to do this, but here it is. They all look very similar. And then for EMBER-3, he said, I know I'm not supposed to do this. But now then he presented all the second-line endocrine therapy and said, this is the first time we've seen 9+ months of PFS, and everything else was more around 5 months. So with all the caveats of indirect comparison, it certainly is interesting, particularly as Rebecca said, even without ESR1, even with prior CDK. Any thoughts about how you would, theoretically, if you could apply it, how you would apply it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's really interesting because it actually confirms in a way post-Monarch this idea of CDK after CDK. So it's another suggestion of this, but with all the caveats of cross-trial comparisons, the PFS here is longer than it was in post-Monarch. And so I do think that if this gets approved, I will use it in sequence. And I think one of the big questions, if we, depending on how Sarita 6 turns out, is, well, what happens if you've already switched somebody to gamizestrant for ESR1 mutation? What are you going to do in the second line setting? I think we'll have to sort that out.
So, and also, I guess another thing that Hal talked about, and Rebecca, I'm curious about your thoughts on it, was the issue of the tolerability of SERDs. Because, you know, the imlunestrant monotherapy looks very similar to elacestrant. The camizestrant data looks very similar. So you would imagine maybe you'll have all threes at some point. Are you able to distinguish the tolerability? I hear about things like photopsia, bradycardia, Rebecca. Anything, is one better tolerated? Any evidence that one's better, more effective?
So as I said, I think bottom line is we have many options now. I think it's going to be challenging, to be honest with you. I think one of the things, as I said, they comment on the imlunestrant was that unlike the CAMI data and elacestrant and some of the others, it looked to see that that signal was there regardless of an ESR1 mutation, which is, I think, fundamentally different. We'll have to see larger data sets and longer follow-up to understand that better. I think it's really interesting. I find it's quite individualized. I think we do get a bit nervous, I would say, you know, following ECGs and doing those things. Thankfully, I think it has been a rarer side effect, and I think we're much more vigilant than we were, let's say, when we were starting some of these other trials 20 years ago. But I think time will tell as we use these also in more broader populations. I always say when you do things in trial, you're getting the fittest, you know, most well-tolerated. It's only when you get out into clinical practice, it's kind of like we're seeing with all the CDK inhibitors, the pneumonitis and ILD that exist with all of them, but it's rare. But it does happen. So I think we're reassured. Some of the first generations that I saw in phase one were concerning me, but now that we're seeing in phase three at better doses, I think they are better tolerated.
So a couple words about PIK3, P10, AKT mutant breast cancer. I was mentioning there's a press release saying CAPI works in prostate cancer. We haven't seen how well it works, but we're going to find out pretty soon, I hope. I guess Rebecca got into the biology of this in her talk. We saw some updated data looking at CAPI. We actually had three posters that our group presented at the San Antonio meeting, and one of them was looking at investigators' choice of treatment of PIK3 positive disease, and it was like complete shift from alpelisib to CAPI visertib there, I think primarily based on toxicity. And before we get to the INNOVO study, any comments about Capitella and about capivasertib? Nancy, Rebecca was bringing up the issue of diarrhea. I was been curious about diabetes tolerance, what you're seeing with Capi compared to what you had been seeing with alpelisib.
Yeah, I mean, I think in our experience, capivasertib is indeed better tolerated than alpelisib. We are actually seeing, it's not just like the statistics and the numbers in the tables, but we are experiencing that in the patients that we're treating. Alpelisib, I think my personal rate of discontinuation due to toxicity was rather high, even despite like doing all the prophylactic everything. Whereas with capivasertib, I think people are able to stay on a little bit better. You know, I do think that with all of these drugs, and we'll talk about INAVO in a minute, but I think the glucose management is actually one of the more challenging things as an oncologist, because I don't personally feel like I was well-trained in endocrinology, and endocrinologists are not so easy to find, actually, in the U.S. on short notice. So I do think that that is a challenge with all of this class of drugs.
Yeah, we've been talking about doing a diabetes 101 course for oncologists. I certainly could use it. Really curious what happens with the prostate. This trial, they're giving it with abiraterone and prednisone. Oh, so I'm going to be really curious to see how they do with glucose tolerance with replacement steroids on board. We were talking about another practice-changing trial that came out at San Antonio the year before, the INNOVO 120 study of inavolisib with palbo and fulvestrant for patients with PIK3 mutant disease. Rebecca, can you kind of remind us of what the study looked at? It had really, again, another trial with a great hazard rate, and in particular, how it's affecting your practice right now. This is an approved option, and this is in patients with endocrine-resistant disease. So can you talk about in what situations you're using this strategy, Rebecca, and what you're seeing in terms of tolerability?
So just to remind everyone, we've come a long way with these, PI3 kinase inhibitors. We used to be very dirty drugs, and now we're getting to sort of being much more focused, meaning sort of iNovo, it is a selective inhibitor of the sort of specific catalytic alpha isoform. And why that subunit, why that's so important, is that the efficacy seems to be improving and toxicity seems to be reducing. So that's just, anybody who's been involved in the older BEL2 trials and a lot of these older drugs, these next generation drugs are more active with fewer side effects. And that's really relevant because, as you said, your own sort of poster had shown that people are shifting away from alpelisib. So people want better, efficacy, but they're really struggling with the side effects. So this study looked at specifically patients who had a PIK3CA mutation, so very poor prognosis patients who had this early relapse, and patients got the triplet, so looking at iNovo, Palbo, and fulvestrant versus just the doublet. And I think we were all we all remember San Antonio, the data press releases Monday, presented Friday, and Hope, amazingly, she didn't have the advantage of all of us there going, oh. So it was 7 months, versus 15 months. And, this was like a PFS. We could all go, oh yeah, this is real. Hazard ratio 0.43, confidence interval was really tight. And then all the other measures that we've seen in subsequent studies, looking at time to discontinuation, like 15 versus 20, almost 25, time to going to subsequent chemo, again, hasn't been reached in the triplet. So this is real data. The curves separate quickly. Now, I don't have access to this compound yet. We've had to use it on trials here. My own sort of feeling is that we're seeing side effects that are better than what we saw with alpelisib. People are quite motivated to do it, but I would tend to echo those comments that we do need a bit of a training for the hyperglycemia. We do, I think, await data on overall survival that should read out this year. But I think this is for a very poor prognosis group of patients. All of us are sitting in clinic, these really early relapsers. And I think you can get these biopsies now, because I think that's the other thing, is that you could do a liquid, the concordance in terms of PIK3CA mutations from tumor to liquid is very high. So this is a group of patients, somebody recurs quickly, you can get this information.
So, yeah, we were doing CME meetings that year, too, and all the bodies were there. Virginia Caclamani, who runs the San Antonio meeting, was working with us, and they were all, trying to figure out how they can get this, break the world record for presentation. One thing I just want to mention about this, Nancy, I don't know why I never thought about it. I guess if you have a de novo metastatic PIK3 positive, they wouldn't be eligible, right? Because they have to be endocrine resistant.
Yeah, and I think that, we have generally stuck with the eligibility of the trial. The FDA label, interestingly, is broader, so it does, which I agree with. I think it gives you clinicians flexibility based on the clinical scenario. But we've mostly stuck with the clinical trial eligibility just because there is the availability of PI3 kinase inhibitors in later lines. And so it's not clear yet whether doing everything up front for all patients is required versus a sequential approach of endocrine therapy CDK4 and then a endocrine therapy PI3 kinase combo later. But it's really the high-risk patients, the patients with aggressive disease, the patients with a short disease-free, essentially relapsed on endocrine therapy. These are the patients that where it thinks the additional toxicity is worth the gain.
Yeah, I mean, the real challenge, I think, is the people who've had endocrine therapy and stopped. The trial allowed them to go in, I think, up to a year. But again, with the FDA thing, theoretically, it could be more than a year. And just to show you a slide that Rebecca had that I thought makes this point I was saying about hazard rates, which you see, with these AKT strategies, really good hazard rate, even alpelisib also as well, but CAPI has rate of 0.5, inavolisib 0.43, so hormonal targeted therapy works, I think you could say. All right, antibody drug conjugates. We're going to start out talking about HER2 negative disease and then HER2 positive. And of course, in terms of HER2 negative, we now have the approval of Dato-DXd. We saw some more data on that, as well as T-DXd in the first line, and in particular, T-DXd in the ultra-low patients. So let's start out with T-DXd, Rebecca, and maybe you can kind of briefly remind us about the DESTINY-Breast06 presented last year at ASCO, again, looking at HER2-low, ultra-low. But again, this is hormone receptor-positive disease. So can you talk about what the trial looked at, what they found, Rebecca, and from your point of view, the ideal approach to implementing it in practice?
Yeah, thanks. So I think, you know, we know from Breast-04, you know, that looking at patients who had had endocrine and chemo, that clearly T-DXd was superior to sort of standard of care chemo in patients that had had endocrine therapy followed by chemo. And so Breast-06 was different in that it was right after patients have had endocrine therapy, so it was their first chemo for metastatic disease. It also included these ultra-low patients that we weren't as familiar with classifying. And so I think what was, this was, I picked out this one because I think this is really important because we have to individualize it. Who do we treat? And I think, you know, if you look at those patients that had less than 6 months first-line time to progression of endocrine and CDK, there is a dramatic improvement. So we're seeing here up to 14 months with T-DXd versus standard of care chemotherapy. Hazard ratios in the sort of 0.3 category, which, again, we don't see very often in breast. You know, we do see the impact with 6 to 12 and greater than 12, but it's most dramatic in this less than 6 months. And, you know, why this is so important in clinical practice is that, you know, we're having to decide, you know, which patients should we use it on? A lot of people are like not so comfortable with the early transition, but clearly we have to personalize this, and there's a group of patients where it matters. This is the PFS2 data, six months, and I was really amazed how much the Breast-06 and Breast-04 data look quite similar. And I think expect to see some other data coming up likely in the next 6 months as well, looking at some of these other subgroups that I think are relevant for Breast-06 as we try to tease out who really should we put on T-DXd. I think this compound in terms of an ADC is very different from all the other compounds, quite honestly. HER2 really is the surface marker that is used to get the drug into the cell. And I think we're seeing quite extraordinary paradigm shifts in activity in a group of patients on the study.
Nancy, anything you want to add to that? And also the issue of HER2 ultra-low ER negative disease, which wasn't looked at. Of course, there are very few patients you can understand why. I don't know if it is going to be looked at, but from a practical point of view, a patient who has a hormone receptor positive ultra low, no other options, have you used T-DXd?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that one very practical comment is that when you see a patient who has HER2 zero disease by IHC, now you have to go back to the pathologist and ask them if it's ultra-low. So that's the practical aspect of it. And I certainly would use this in the hormone receptor-positive HER2 ultra-low patients who were certainly included in DB06. I think the question that you had was, what about the triple-negative ultra-low patients? I am not aware of any trials that are specifically looking at that population, and I'm not sure we'll have phase 3 data. We might have some, you know, real-world type of data. I actually have not tried getting this reimbursed as of yet. I will say from a practical standpoint, we tend to use any biopsy. So if any biopsy in a triple negative patient is HER2 low, we will go for T-DXd. We will suggest T-DXd at some point in time. And that does get insurance reimbursement. So you're really only talking about the patients who, like, every single biopsy has been HER2 zero and the triple negative. And I would personally tend to give them sacituzumab, for example, first, because I think there's more data there. I wouldn't rule out giving T-DXd, but I think it would be if they were truly HER2 low, ultra low. But I haven't actually, I will say, I haven't tried doing it yet.
Yeah, I'd be curious to know if anybody's done that or seen some responses. You know, we just came back from the Society of Gynecologic Oncology meeting. We did a program on HER2 positive gynecologic cancers, and we showed a bunch of videos of gynecologic oncologists in practice presenting cases. And finally, we haven't seen this until now, we start to hear cases of people really getting treated with T-DXd and responding. And I saw that same look on their face that I saw 4 or 5 years ago in oncologists. They started to see what this really meant in terms of patient care. So now you're starting to see it outside of breast cancer. Well, just to try to make it a little more complicated, we have another ADC, Rebecca, available, now approved, Dato-DXd, HER2 positive disease. Maybe you can comment on what we know there in terms of the activity, tolerability. I'm curious what your experience has been with mucositis. This is an ADC that we're hearing a little bit more about that. And in particular, really interested from both of you about where you think this, where you're sequencing this. What comes first, SASE or Dato? So any general comments to Rebecca?
Well, so first of all, if people haven't heard of it, it's another TROP2-directed ADC. I think most importantly, it's given every 3 weeks intravenously. I think for those of us in clinical practice, these scheduling issues are important. The toxicity is really important. So these are patients that are randomized, who'd had endocrine therapy, had chemotherapy, randomized to either receive a standard of care chemo versus Dato-DXd. Very similar data, to be honest, that we see with sacituzumab in this context, sort of a couple of months improvement in PFS. Unfortunately, it did not reach its overall survival endpoint. I suspect it's just in terms of historically when this trial was done, there weren't, you know, when they did the sacituzumab ER-positive trials, they had access, they didn't have access to subsequent agents, whereas in the TROPION-01 study, they would have had access to other ADCs and other therapies. So I think these compounds in terms of efficacy, quite honestly, are quite similar. How we're going to choose our drugs, I do think is going to be on schedule and side effects. So if someone's tolerating SASI well and doesn't have any issues about diarrhea and low blood counts, they might, you know, be able to do SASI. You know, the Dato, you mentioned, you know, so it doesn't seem to have ILD, doesn't seem to have the diarrhea. And fatigue, actually, for me, that's one thing I've noticed by using the same compounds. Ironically, I always tell people, you know, the longer you're on treatment, you know, that's where things start to get, you know, if you've got a drug that works, can you continue that drug? And so in some patients, SASI, they tolerate it well. In others, fatigue has become an issue for me in counts. In Dato, fatigue doesn't seem to be low blood counts, but the mouth mucositis is very different, and they have to use prophylaxis. Once it happens, it's hard for it to reverse. So it's really important, much like I think we're seeing with everolimus, we're much better now at giving it prophylactically. And I think we have to see sort of larger, broader groups of patients get it. And then as we talked about, we'll have to see the first line trials in TNBC, again, just sort of looking at the side effect profile. I think how we're choosing drugs. My hope is that in the future, AI can kind of give us a sense, okay, you need to get this sort of surface marker-directed drug, this potential payload. I think that's going to matter a lot for how we choose our drugs.
AI, that's interesting. All right, let's talk about ADCs or HER2-positive disease. One thing I just want to comment on is you showed this slide, Rebecca. I thought it was interesting looking at the CLEOPATRA trial compared to, of course, CLEOPATRA, looking at pertuzumab, trastuzumab, and docetaxel. But then, as I mentioned before, presented originally 2011, then the DESTINY second line trial, where you had a really incredible benefit there of T-DXd over T-DM1. And I guess the real question, Nancy, is going to be this trial, DESTINY Breast 09, looking at first line T-DXd. We were talking before about endocrine therapy and palbo and CDK and HER2-positive disease. We may have to think through that whole thing if this trial is positive, which, I don't think they're taking any more wagers in Las Vegas on this because most people are expecting it to be positive, although I think there'd be pretty good wagering going on about the pertuzumab. But Nancy, any thoughts? You know, we're going to wake up one day and there may be another press release saying this is positive.
Yep.
And I believe they use it indefinitely, too. So the question is, where's palbo going to fit in? Are you really going to use it indefinitely? Do you expect it to be positive? And do you know when it's going to be presented? This is like a memory test, Nancy.
Right.
You can remember all my questions.
So I don't know when it's going to be presented. I do think it'll probably be positive. And if it is, I do think it'll change practice, assuming that it is sufficiently positive to overcome the toxicity profile. I think the big question is really, as you say, well, there's a couple questions. One is, it is possible that this is going to be so effective that it cures some proportion of patients with metastatic breast cancer. And then the trick is going to be to figure out who could just stop everything. I think the other question is going to be for the majority of patients, like, do we really need to give it forever till progression? Are you really going to give people 4 or 5 years of continuous every 3 week T-DXd, or can you give an induction and then give some sort of HP or HP-like maintenance or a patina-like maintenance or what have you? So I think that's going to be the big practical question that comes up if DB09 is positive.
Anything you want to add to that, Rebecca? And also, Where's the next stop for T-DXd? In your talk, I think you were the one who did the update on the Catherine trial that you see there, Chuck Geyer from the NSABP presented. And, you know, the post-adjuvant space, of course, there's a lot of interest in. Tucatinib is being looked at there. I think T-DXd is looking at that. I don't know if there are adjuvant, neoadjuvant trials in T-DXd. Rebecca, where do you see what's next after first-line therapy in Mets for T-DXd?
Well, I don't want to steal Nancy's fire, but I think the bottom line is Nancy's done some amazing work in sort of CNS metastases with T-DXd and other compounds. And I think, truthfully, that's been our really unmet need is these patients that have, you know, either isolated disease or that remains a challenge. So I think shifting these into the adjuvant or neoadjuvant context, we're going to be seeing actually trials read out. So there's T-DM1 versus T-DXd in that residual disease setting. There are some neoadjuvant trials going on. So yeah, so the move is going to be to see it in the early breast cancer setting. Can we actually prevent CNS metastases in the first place? Can we cure patients in that setting is probably the most important question for all of us.
And of course, now we have some data, and I'm hearing different answers to the same question that I asked a couple years ago in terms of how people deal with patients with brain mets, particularly in the second line setting. Nancy, and here's Destiny Breast 12 that looked at HER2 TDXD, actually HER2 with and without brain mets, but this is a segment that had brain mets and pretty interesting activity there, and I'm hearing a lot of people talk, you know, prior to this, 2-3 years ago, when we said, what's your second-line therapy after TCP for metastatic disease with brain mets? We were hearing the HER-CLIMB with tucatinib. Now I'm hearing people, and even when we do surveys, they're giving this answer, TDXD. I mean, 71% response rate. Any comments, Nancy?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very large cohort. It's not a randomized study, but there are 263 patients involved. The median PFS was 17 months, and so that also, I think, alleviated some of the concern about whether T-DXd would suppress new brain mets from appearing, so that wasn't really known. But, you know, with this, CNS would be counted as an event, so we are seeing that there must be some suppression happening. The CNS response rate was 70% overall. It was actually over 80% in patients who had not previously had radiation, so we're seeing very, very good activity. As a comparator in HER2-CLIMB, although with a more heavily pretreated population, the HER2-CLIMB CNS response rate was around 50%. And the PFS on average was shorter. So I think we are seeing really robust activity with T-DXd, really fairly in line with what we are seeing in the non-brain met population, over 90% one-year survival. So I really do feel comfortable using this now in the second-line setting in patients with even active brain metastases.
So I guess, you know, another question, Nancy, this came up with HER-CLIMB as well, is what are the situations where you would hold off on radiation therapy, particularly if it had to be whole brain, and use systemic therapy like HER-CLIMB or now it seems like T-DXd? Is that a strategy you'll use in somebody without CNS symptoms?
I do. You know, the HER2-positive patients, even with brain mets, they can have extended survival. So we are seeing in some of the academic databases, median survival of HER2-positive brain met of 3 years or longer, and about 40% of people alive at 5 years. We never would have seen that before. And you do see whole brain late toxicity when you give it early. So eventually, many people end up getting whole brain radiation, but we're just trying to kick the can down the road and give it later so that we're avoiding this late toxicity, which can be very devastating. If somebody's a candidate for very simple SRS, they have 3 lesions, are in HP maintenance, I generally send them to radiation oncology. They get their SRS, and they continue HP along their merry way. But for the patient who has multiple lesions or who has SRS, and then 3 months later, there's 6 new lesions that appear, that's really the person I'm putting on systemic therapy.
So, and here's Nancy's conclusion about the Destiny Press trial. I want to talk about a topic we don't talk about that much, but we actually had one of our posters at San Antonio. We looked at the issue of post-adjuvant neratinib, and we had a couple of papers this year looking at neratinib metastatic disease. Nancy, can you comment on this? And this, again, your area of interest and expertise in this situation for brain mets, combining it with T-DM1. What's the biology of the thinking behind this combination, and what about this regimen clinically?
Yeah, so I think that on the left is some data from Memorial Sloan Kettering showing that actually what neratinib does is it drives HER2 receptor intracellularly. And remember, T-DM1 does not have a bystander effect, so you need to get it in the cell to have an effect. So essentially what neratinib is doing is driving T-DM1 into the cell. And on the right is data from a brain met PDX model showing that neratinib monotherapy basically is inactive. T-DM1 has some activity, but with T-DM1 plus neratinib, you're seeing complete responses. And so we looked at this combination. This was led by Rachel Friedman in patients either without previous T-DM1 or who had actually progressed on prior T-DM1. So we're looking to see, does it overcome T-DM1 resistance? And I think that's the most interesting cohort. So in the previous T-DM1 exposed patients, the response rate is 28% with a 12-month OS of 80%. So we are seeing this. And with monotherapy, neratinib, we only see 8% CNS response rate. So there is something happening with the combination, and I think it's very interesting. Very few patients had had previous tucatinib. Very few patients had previous T-DXd. So we really don't know if this response rate will hold up. But I do think it's, we are needing to have regimens for patients who've had both tucatinib, CAPE, as well as T-DXd. So it's nice to have another option for these patients who have CNS disease.
Well, Nancy, what about the issue of HER2 mutant disease? Of course, in non-small cell lung cancer, this is the most common use of T-DXd is HER2 mutant disease. They use it in the first line setting. But what about neratinib plus trastuzumab with these mutant, it's a TKI, neratinib in terms of HER2 mutations of the SUMMIT trial. Any comment? How often do you see HER2 mutant disease in breast cancer, Nancy? And any thoughts about this trial?
Yeah, I thought this was a fascinating trial. So we've already seen data for HER2 mutant ER positive breast cancer where the triplet of neratinib, trastuzumab, fulvestrant is very active. But the question is, what about triple negative breast cancer, more aggressive type of breast cancer? And HER2 mutations here are found only about less than 2% of the time. So they're not very common. But amazingly, the response rate here was between 35% to 40%. And with the doublet of neratinib trastuzumab, you saw a median PFS of 6.2 months. So if you think about like data for the ribulin or other sort of late line, triple negative metastatic trials, I mean, these data look pretty compelling to me.
So I just want to finish out with something I think we had some great other content that was presented we were going to get to tonight, but I want to try to finish on time. But I did want to get into the issue of ADCs, and particularly, Rebecca, the issue of sequencing ADCs. We talked about now that we have another ADC, Dato-DXd, now approved for hormone receptor-positive breast cancer. We talked about that. But Nancy put together some interesting slides looking at the different ADCs and the data. We're not going to go through all the details that are available right now with hormone receptor positive, but also triple negative metastatic breast cancer. Anything you want to say about the way you sequence in this situation, particularly the issue of where Dato is fitting in, both mainly with, we know it's approved with hormone receptor positive, but even theoretically with triple negative, you went through some data looking at that as well. Any comments, Rebecca?
Sure. I think first, as Nancy alluded to, the largest body of literature that we have in triple negative is with sacituzumab. So I think this is sort of our go-to ADC for metastatic TNBC. I think a lot of us are using T-DXd in our patients that are sort of triple negative, HER2 low, but I think we prioritize over T-DXd, except maybe in the context of someone that has CNS metastases, because certainly I haven't had a lot of success with SASI and brain mets, and so I've been actually prioritizing T-DXd and have had some modest sort of benefits. What we have now, though, is we have a number of first-line trials looking at either an ADC on its own or an ADC plus immunotherapy in patients that are PD-L1 positive. And we think that that actually has some synergy in upregulating STING. And so I think bottom line is please watch out for those trials because those are going to read out essentially by the end of the year, all of those trials. We also have a newcomer, sac-TMT, which looks like another highly potent TROP2-directed ADC, and that seems to be in the sort of stomatitis, myelosuppression toxicity. And then it comes to sequencing, you were asking me. I think there's a lot to be learned. Most of the patients do better with their first ADC, but if you actually look at the plots, some of the patients actually do get benefits in their second. So if money permits, I think many of us are going into that second-line ADC as well.
Yeah, I've been talking up. There was a big ADC education session at San Antonio that I found fantastic. We really got into a lot of the issues of sequencing and resistance to ADCs. Of course, this goes way beyond breast cancer as well. So I want to thank our faculty, Rebecca and Nancy, for working with us tonight and also doing these presentations. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Rebecca. Thanks so much, Nancy. Have a good one.
Thank you.